I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It is a cruel paradox of the music world that the older a finely made violin gets, the better it sounds. For even the most skilled luthier, there is something ineffable about the aging of the wood, the seasoning of the sound. Don't try to describe it, just listen to it. But the human voice, they say, does not have the same staying power. Some singers blow out their vocal cords before their 30th birthday. Others can get a 30-year career out of their voice, but in most cases, it's thought that the power and the magic of the singer's voice does not age well. I said, in most cases. Today on The Connection, two women whose voices, like fine violins, have matured and assumed a timbre that is every bit as listenable as their days of hammering those high C's. Marilyn Horn and Barbara Cook are now comfortably close, or into their sixth decade as performers. Marilyn is still one of the most influential opera singers in this country. 26 years as a leading lady at the Met alone ought to have been enough, but she went from that to a critically acclaimed second career as a recitalist. Barbara Cook has stood at the very peak of American musical theater. Most singers can only ever dream of achieving her stature and time on Broadway and in Carnegie Hall. Both women still sing, and they teach. So, Connection listeners, we'd like to have you join us on the program today. What is it that determines the durability of the human voice as an instrument? Does maturity bring a quality to the voice that the front office too often ignores by searching for the next new thing? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Marilyn Horn and Barbara Cook are with me in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You don't perform often together. This is the idea of performing together is something that you've only done what, once before, is that right?
Two performances.
And,
yeah, once before.
And then we did a couple of other things before that where we didn't do the whole show.
Yeah, we did Wash That Man Out of,
right,
we
did
wash that man
wonderful
right out of my hair.
Arrangement of that.
Benefits.
Yeah,
on a couple
benefits
of times, right?
Yeah. No, you're right. We don't sing together very often.
We're fixing that.
But are you, would you have been aware of what the other one and the other is doing?
Oh, you bet.
Absolutely.
Even if you're on some Italian opera stage and you're in some Philharmonic, you're sort of, oh, where is she now? What's she doing? Keeping track?
Well, maybe not that close, but certainly aware of...
Definitely aware.
Of what the other's doing. Oh, for sure.
In a competitive
way?
For many years.
No.
Hardly. I mean, we've been in two different fields.
Yeah, our realms have been so different.
We should showcase a little bit of that for some of our listeners. I want to hear, Marilyn, one of your arias. This is from Bianca y Faiero. And by Rossini. This performance from 1986. Can we listen to that?
God, I wish. Oh.
It's a fairly breathtaking performance.
I don't even know what that's where that is in the opera.
Second act, I think. Barbara Cook, be the music critic. Can the woman sing or what?
Are you kidding? You know the answer to that as well as everybody else in the world. You bet.
What do you hear there in the voice? What is it that takes that voice and raises it so far? I mean, what are we talking here? 26 years at the Met, 39 years on stage.
Well, just there's the plain beauty of the sound to begin with, and her technical ability is just astounding. All that ah stuff.
You did the ah stuff. You just did it on a different stage.
I didn't do a lot of that ah stuff. I had a voice teacher who insisted on all of his students learning arias. And I kept saying, Bob, I don't want to do this. It's too hard. I'm not going to be an opera singer. But he finally, you know, he found arias that I liked that weren't right for my voice, but he didn't care. Just get me to do anything, you know. Only when we'd get to the ah stuff, I'd say, I'm not going to do that. It's too hard.
So did someone teach you that, or were you born with that, Marilyn?
What I was born with was the voice, and they say that I started singing with talking at the same time. But the technical stuff, have to work on that.
Do you still?
Well, not in the same way, because I don't sing that kind of music anymore. I've, you know, made the decision. When I stopped opera in 96... I made the decision that I could not compete with myself anymore. You know, you can't compete with what you sounded like at 35. And so that's, I dropped all opera.
What an odd measure, though, to say I'm not able to compete with the singer that I was when I was 35.
Well, ask Roger Clemens, or ask Joe Namath, or ask any of those guys. It's a really half-athletic, half-artistic profession. We're half artist, half athlete. And that's what happens. The muscles in the throat, you know, that control the mechanism are not what they used to be.
That's interesting you talk about athleticism. Because the only time I've ever sung music as difficult is the kind of thing that Marilyn did when I did Candide. And I remember thinking that Glitter and Begay, that aria from Candide, was like an athletic event. It's like a high wire act, you know, and a lot of people sitting out there waiting for you to fall off, too.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. We try not to think about that.
But they are.
But, you know, but the thing is that for an opera singer, it's the whole evening is practically an athletic event. And that's why opera singers can't sing as often as maybe other people do, you know, two or three times a week maximum.
And yet, when you were singing Cunegonde and Candide, you were doing it 8 times a week. Let's listen to a little bit of Glitter and Begay.
I did do that.
Enough, enough of being basely tearful. I'll show my noble stuff by being bright and cheerful.
What a brilliant catch of breath there. You make it dramatic when you have nothing left in your diaphragm.
Was Lenny conducting that?
This is 1956.
No. Sam Krokmalnik, the conductor of the show, was conducting
this. Sure,
the
Sam was an opera conductor.
Yeah.
That was hard work.
Well, it was just, you know, I'm still astounded that I did that. Astounded.
Why?
I don't know. Well, because I'd never done anything even remotely as difficult. I'd never done coloratura work at all. And I hadn't really worked on it with my teacher. And at that point, in public, I'd never sung anything over that little G at the top of the staff. Now, I'm not talking about that big G up there over high C. I'm talking about that little G. I had never sung anything higher than that. And suddenly I have this role in which Lenny must have gone mad. He wrote, you know, I counted the notes one night, or the high notes. And there were 4 E flats over high C. This is for the whole row.
Yep.
6 D flats, 16 B flats, and 21 high Cs written for that row. It's madness, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Madness. And so, you know, I think the reason I did it is because I was used to doing 8 performances a week, and I didn't know I wasn't supposed to be able to do this.
But you were a cocky little kid, too. You turned around to Bernstein, you said, I think we should change this and change this in the role.
I did. Even before I got the job, I did that. It's true.
Because
and
you
he listened and changed it. That's pretty astounding, too, on his part, don't you think?
Yes, yes. Well, Rossini wasn't around. Change anything for me.
You started, Barbara, singing when you were very young.
I sang at the Lions Club and all that stuff and, you know, army camps when I was like 12 and 14. And like Marilyn, I think I was born singing. I have no memory of not being able to sing. So just, you know, it was just this natural voice that was always there, you know, this sweet natural voice that, and I had a teacher who really helped me put it together.
And do you share Marilyn's view that it is part athleticism as well as that just the God-given talent and the training?
Well, yes, I do think so, yeah.
Because somebody was saying to me, I was reading it, I can't remember where I heard this, but if you make the parallel between a pitcher, a baseball pitcher, and a singer, that the base...
That's one of my great parallels that everyone has stolen from me.
Well, I was talking with Marilyn Horan just the other day, and she said to me that if you compare a baseball pitcher to...
Exactly the same thing.
...to a singer, the young baseball pitcher pitches with his arm. The old baseball pitcher pitches with his head.
And his body, his whole body. Yeah. By then, the experience of all the everything the body has to do, wouldn't you think?
Yes. You see, one of the biggest failings of singers is they don't know how to support their voices with their breath support. Big, big, big failing. This is what I hear in so many young singers that I teach. And that's...
What do you mean by that breath support?
The breath has to come out while I'm talking now, right? But when you sing, the breath has to be measured as it comes out, right? So you can make the whole phrase or make a big high note or make a very, very soft note. So you've got to have some underpinnings underneath it. And that, you know, starts with the lungs, obviously, but it's the diaphragm and the stomach muscles and above all the buttocks muscles and the thigh muscles. These all support that air coming out in the right way.
All the way down to the backside and the legs?
You sure? And when, yeah, absolutely.
Does that mean that sitting as we are at the table, you couldn't or wouldn't sing as well as you would if you were standing up and in a posture or pose that you...
No, that's not true, because I would be supporting sitting down. I mean, right now while I'm talking to you, I am supporting my voice.
She got this right? You teach this,
hell,
too.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't get into that part of it, that side of it.
But so how much of it then, Barbara, is just instinct for you?
Well, I think instinct, taste, all of that. Mm. Some of it, I think, is instinct. But for me, what I do when I start working on a new song, what I do is I really investigate the lyric. And sometimes I am drawn to a song because of the melody, because it's a beautiful melody. Or because the words say something that I want to say, that I feel I'd like to stand behind and communicate, you know. And then when I work on it, I go to the lyric and I find a musical pathway and an emotional pathway and put them together.
We're going to come back after the break, talk more about the musical pathway, the emotional pathway, paying attention to the words, all the things that people say isn't really happening that much in music today. Connection listeners, what are you hearing in the singing that you're listening to? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's your chance to join my conversation this hour with Marilyn Horan and Barbara Cook. And we've been talking about singing then, singing now. I thought maybe we could hear a little bit of what Marilyn's doing now. This will... I don't know, maybe I'm out of line here, but I would have said that this is a song that may be familiar to more of our listeners.
There's a land that I've heard of.
are singing about dreams coming true, and that would be, I don't know how we would count it, the third career as a singer. You made the point that you were singing recitals before and during your time as an opera singer, but
right.
This is a new professional incarnation for you.
Well, what's happened now is that I've dropped all the other stuff, and this is what I'm concentrating on. It's, you know, I call it classical popular music. Right?
That's a good way to put it.
Now, I have to ask you, I'm listening to you sing this, and I'm imagining you in the back seat of some stretch limo on your way to an opera performance.
I hate stretch limos.
Oh, don't break the fantasy. I'm telling a story here. And listening to this and wondering, when you were singing opera and known for that, were you thinking, gee, wouldn't it be nice to just kick back with, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow or Bridge Over Troubled Waters or some of the ones that you're singing now?
Well, you see, I started as a child, and so I was singing all of the popular music of the day.
What, you mean the Peggy Lee songs?
Even before that, I did. Yes, of course, you know that I was an original pirate and sang things like Peggy Lee and Kay Starr and Joe Stafford. I mimicked their voices, and then they sold the records for 50 cents in supermarkets. But even before that, as a child, World War II child, I sang for all these bond rallies and scrap drives and all that kind of thing, and I sang the popular songs of the day. So it was always in my blood.
Vera Lynn, Andrews Sisters, that stuff, what were you singing?
Yeah, for sure, absolutely.
I want to hear you do Rosie the Riveter sometime, Marilyn.
I never sang that one. I don't know how I missed it. But the thing is that was going on simultaneously with my lessons to be a classical singer.
So you were never not a fan of popular music. You just...
Absolutely not. It just, I on the, in the big bulk of my career, which is very long, I felt that the two vocal styles were not to be mixed very often because there's a very great control that I needed for the kind of music that I sing, you know.
Can we use the athletic example again and say you're being, you know, finely tuned as a pitcher.
Right.
You don't play catcher in the next game.
You got it. Marilyn, That's exactly it. You don't go into the outfield.
Let me ask you a question. How early on would you say that you felt the quality of your voice and the richness of your voice was right for opera?
Well, I had some, you know, really good advice going on. For instance, my father was my mentor. He was a semi-professional tenor. No. He was saying, no, you can't go into opera too soon. As it is, I went in at 20, and that's considered very young. But he meant no going in at 16, mm-hmm. because my voice was pretty developed by then. And I remember very clearly that I always had this really high voice, and that at age 15, suddenly a whole octave arrived on the lower part of my voice, which had nothing to do with anything except hormones.
Could you sing with it right away, or like a boy going through puberty, did you have to learn
how to use it? No, I sang with it right away, but I didn't use it. I would just fool around with it and say, oh, I can sing low, too.
Well, there's a kind of, how can I put this, richness of vocal texture, if you will, that opera singers have.
I think it got richer as the years went on.
I really do.
But, you know, this fooling around with the low voice, that's how I got the job of dubbing Dorothy Dandridge in Carmen Jones when I was 20.
On the film track?
Absolutely.
I didn't know that.
C'est moi. I just, after I had sung Michaela's aria in French, I heard all of these women singing the habanero with the Hammerstein lyrics, and I was pretty cheeky, and I said, I can sing low, too. And that's when it happened.
I want to do something to test vocal texture. I think those were your words, Barbara, by listening to two versions of the same song, one of yours recorded a few years back and one recorded...
Oh, Lord, help me.
No, this will be fun. What are we going to hear? We're going to listen to, from She Loves Me, which our listeners may be more familiar with as the film version, You've Got Mail. But you're singing at this point the female lead in Ice Cream. The song is Ice Cream. The production is She Loves Me. Can we listen to a little bit of that? This is recorded in 1963. Count them. That would be 40 years ago.
I was so nasty. Well, he deserved it, but even so, that George is not like this George. This is a new George that I don't know. Somehow
Connection listeners, don't touch that dial. 38 years later, in Carnegie Hall at the Barbara Cook concert, there, the same song from the same show.
Last night, I was so nasty. Well, he deserved it, but even so, that George is not like this George. This is a new George that I don't know. It all reminds me of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. For right before my eyes, the man that I despise has turned into a man I like. It's almost like a dream, and strange as it may seem, he came to offer me.
That's the voice of Barbara Cook. Marilyn Horne, she nailed the B again, didn't she?
She sure did.
But let me hear the two of you talk about that, because I hear a much richer, a much more mature, and in many ways more listenable voice in the Carnegie Hall concert.
I think so, yeah.
I think you're dealing much more with the words.
That's true.
And you really have to, the words are where it's at with songs.
Also, my voice was so much lighter. You know,
you sound like Kristen Chenoweth in the first one.
Oh, yeah?
Or she sounds like you.
When I was younger, it was a much lighter voice, so I could sing higher and do more stuff with it, you know. And there's a kind of shimmer there. But I enjoy listening to the second one more, really.
I hear more humor in the second one. Yeah. Almost, I think maybe it's exactly what you're saying, Marilyn. It's more an appreciation of what's in the words that you're actually telling me that story rather than singing a song. Is that a reasonable distinction?
You know, I think something happens that's automatic, too, because the thrust of what I want to do so much is to communicate. And when how can I put this? When it's like there's certain things that are not there in the voice anymore, I think it's automatic to try to put more in from other elements, the acting part of it, if you will, you know, for lack of a better way to say it. Because you want to communicate, you want to, you know, to grab them. And I don't have that crystalline, shimmery kind of thing that I had when I was so much younger. I have other stuff that I think is more interesting. So I think even without even thinking about it, it's just an automatic adjustment that I make.
I think we all do. And I think, you know, it's the same thing as if you were singing German Lieder, you know, in the early days, they'll write a review and say, well, she really sang it wonderfully, but she will deepen in her interpretation of this as the years go on. And it's true.
It is true.
It is true. But I have to qualify that and say, I think what a young person has to say is valid, too.
1-800-423-8255. Audrey's calling in from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Audrey.
Hi. I'm a little nervous. I'm calling to say hello to Barbara, who was nice enough to meet me the last time that she was at Symphony Hall. I took a pretty hard hit as a result of 9/11 a couple of years ago, and Barbara's musical gifts and her interpretation and attention to the lyrics, as she was talking about before, especially Barbara of Sondheim's work, really brought music back into my life and had a profound healing effect for me. And I'm so happy to have turned on the radio and to hear your voice and to know that you're in town again. And
I
just wanted to say hello.
I remember meeting you and talking to you. And thank you so much. If anything I've done helps, I'm so grateful for that. I do remember meeting you.
Good.
Audrey, thank
you.
Thanks
Thank
for calling
you.
In. No, it's nice to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
I'm interested in hearing from both of you.
I'm sorry.
No. Do you think about this when you're up on the stage? I mean, you're supposed to pick a pair of eyeglasses and sing to the reflection on those or look above the heads. And I
don't think about any of that. I just do it. I mean, I'm not conscious of, oh, I've got to reach them. Because so much of my work is internal. And what I do is try to set the stage so that people will come to me. I don't try to reach out and grab them by the throat and say, listen, you know, I don't think I do, sometimes maybe. But generally, what I'm doing is I'm doing my work. And some people will come to you and some won't, because some people, I think...
It's not that simple, some people, though, because
well, some
your
people,
work
I think,
is
are frightened
people.
Of their own emotional stuff. So they won't come, and there's nothing you can do about that.
I think that what we're doing, what I feel I'm doing, is a combination of going out to the public that's there and also bringing them to me. I used to say that in opera, I feel more like I'm going out and over the orchestra to the people, mm-hmm. but that in recital, I try to bring the people to me. Well, I think now I think it's a combination. I really, as I've advanced in years, I think that it's the combination of both. You're going out and bringing them in.
Do you catch yourself sometimes, Marilyn, singing something that's very familiar and thinking, no, focus, pay attention,
oh,
get
please.
Back.
Oh, please, absolutely. Good Lord. There are those days when you just cannot focus there. I mean, there may be distractions in the hall, you know, mm-hmm. those two reflective glasses that you talked about, they may just suddenly take your attention. The craziest things can do it. And you're thinking, oh God, did I send my laundry or not? It's ghastly. You have to really almost slap yourself in the face. Thank God it doesn't happen very often.
Let's take another call from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thomas is joining us now. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you for calling.
Sure. I apologize to Ms. Horn. I'm not a huge opera follower, so I'm not as familiar
well,
with your
we
work,
have to do something about that.
I'm sorry. But I have followed for a long time Ms. Cook's career, and I guess I would like the opinion of both of you on something that I observe. I am not a huge fan at all this reality TV and American Idol type shows.
I hate it.
All these new singing shows. But the thing I notice all the time that really kind of irks me is it seems like all these young singers don't trust lyricists. They find this need to embellish with all this vocal
trickery.
You're
talking about all that melisma. I think when it's used properly, it's fine, but all these...
What's melisma?
All these gospel things that people do. It's, you know, it's like the hula hoop. Right now, melisma is in.
It's the Whitney Houston...
Yeah, excuse me for interrupting you, but...
No. I want to hear...
It bothers me because I think they just sort of impose melisma on a song, and half of them don't know how the hell to do it right
how
anyway.
How about... Oh, say,
yeah,
can you see?
That's what I'm talking about. I hate to tell you what I think about that, but I think you get the
picture.
I
really do believe, though, if people would just trust, you know, when I think about the music of, like, a Lorenz Hart and a Richard Rodgers and, you know, these
well,
sort
you,
of songwriters.
Do you know something? I'm interrupting again. I'm probably not going to get this exactly right. I happen to see on our PBS station in New York, a show about Jan Pierce, the tenor, the great tenor. And he said that he was having trouble with a vocal line or something when he was working with Toscanini. And Toscanini said something like, go to the words and the tone will come. And that, I was very impressed by that, because I think what he was saying is invest yourself into the lyric, and then you won't be so concerned about the sound. Do you know what I mean?
Great advice.
Yeah.
Just great advice.
But Marilyn, how much harder is that to do if you're handed a score that's in Italian or in German and expected to pluck from that the nuance in a language that's not your first tongue?
But they're my second and third tongues. I speak them both.
And that's important, is it?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, to me, this is a classic example of how important the words are, that you can't just read what somebody tells you these words sound like.
You bet. I mean, most of us in America who did not come from a family with a, you know, a second language or even a first language, a lot of people were native Italian speakers, you know, but we had to start first with phonetics, and then you better learn the languages fast. That is just paramount, because that doesn't mean anything if you aren't connected to the words.
Isn't it interesting that I thought we would I didn't think that the words would end up being as central to.
And it it'll bring out the coloration of the voice that you want. I remember one of my teachers was Lotte Lehmann, the great German soprano, and this was years and years ago when I was really just starting in opera, and I said, oh, she said, what are you singing next season? I said, well, I'm singing this, I'm singing that, and blah blah blah. And I said, oh, and I'm going to, when I sing that part, I'm going to color my voice very light and girlish. When I sing this, I'm going to do something. She mm-hmm. said, you know, Jackie, if that's my nickname, if you just think about the character, the correct coloration will come right out from the words. And she was so right.
Well, do you know, when I do my concerts, one of the last songs I do, and I do this because normally I wouldn't sing this song, but it's one of the songs that Stephen Sondheim says he wishes he had written, and that's the trolley song, you know, for Meet Me in St. Louis. Oh. And when I do that, just automatically I become this young girl, my voice gets lighter, but it doesn't, it's not because I'm thinking, oh, make my voice light, it's because I'm becoming this person, or trying to.
I need to stop you both. We're going to take a very short break. Our number, Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Barbara Cook and Marilyn Horne are my guests. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Barbara Cook and Marilyn Horne are in the studio with me. These two great voices are here to talk with you. We'll take another call. Yes, we will. From Boston. Ed's on the line. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I just want Barbara to know that when I was about 16 in the Daubery Room in Copley Square, then in Copley Square, Boston, I fell in love with Barbara, and I'm still in love with her. I mean, she was fabulous then, and she's fabulous now.
Well, that's very sweet of you, the Daubery Room.
You remember that?
Oh, God, very well. You know, I learned a lot there. I really did.
So did I.
Is it a cabaret?
It was a supper club, they called them. And we did shows based on different composers. I was there for about 9 months. We'd do a show based on the music of Jerome Kern, then Rogers and Hart, and Cole
Porter. You learned a lot doing that.
I did, because I had never done theater at that point. And we had a few little lines of dialogue here and there. And it was a very good learning.
Was it a set piece, or did you interact with the audience?
There were, if I remember correctly, four or five of us who somehow found a way to make a little story every time. And we'd play each show for maybe a month and change. And, we got lots of people in there. And I learned a lot doing that.
Well, when you came over to our table and sang to me, I almost fainted.
Did I do that? Oh, my sakes.
It was terrific.
I have a question for you.
Who, go ahead.
Are you coming to the concert tomorrow evening? You're here in Boston.
Wild horses couldn't keep me away.
Oh, that's nice.
Good. Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Ed.
Yeah,
good to have you on the program. To Manchester, Massachusetts, Teresa's now with us. Hi, Teresa.
Yes, hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling in.
Good. My mother was an opera singer, so I say hello to Marilyn Horne.
Hi.
My mother always went backstage. We would go to concerts, and she would, I'm getting 50s, forget me, but all these people that we would go hear, she would go backstage and talk to. But my big debate with my husband is he keeps saying, well, why don't they sing opera in English? Because then we could understand what they're saying. And I keep saying, oh, no, they can't do that because of the tone and the quality of the Italian, say. Do you agree with that, or how do you feel about it?
I am of two minds on that. I'm sorry to be wishy-washy. I prefer to sing in the original language, obviously, because it was written for the original language, and the vowel sounds and everything go in the right place. But I made the first part of my operatic career in a small provincial opera house in Germany called Gelsenkirchen, which is in the middle of the Ruhr Valley. And most people would note that it's being 10 Ks from Essen, where they built all those big guns and things. Anyway, we sang everything in German. Everything. I sang Mimi, I sang Italian opera, I mean, everything in German. And I have to say that I do think that it would be great in a city the size of New York, for instance, or Boston, that there would be an opera company that sang everything in English, because it really makes it accessible. And I agree with your husband in that respect, and I agree with you in the other respect. Yeah. I think we should have both. Sorry, as I said, I'm wishy-washy, but I firmly believe both things.
Oh, that makes us all both happy. My mother, actually, she was singing in Europe. She had a show. She sang in Vienna. She had a show in Poland, an hour show on the radio.
Oh, really?
And then an hour show in Vienna.
Well, I still think, you know, of the German words in many of the operas that I
say. My father also says that Shakespeare is the best in German.
Oh, he must be a German, because that's what they all say.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Teresa. Yeah. I want to ask you both about something which has sort of come up in conversation, and that is, you say that the spirit, the color of the singing comes so much from the words and from the character, but something has changed for both of you in that, Barbara, you're no longer Marion the librarian, you're Barbara Cook on the stage, and Marilyn, you're not impersonating a Venetian general wearing pants. You are Marilyn Horne on the stage. So you don't get the, what's the word I would, what would you call it? Not the comfort, but you don't get the character to inhabit. You have to be you on the stage now. Is that harder?
In some ways it is.
I'm thinking.
In some ways it is, in some ways it's not. It's liberating in many ways, I think.
I agree that it's liberating. And you know, I think that we paint a picture for ourselves in our heads of each song that we're singing. And we're coming out as a character. Mm. If it's a Marilyn Horne character, but we're using those words to paint a picture.
So do we have the Marilyn Horne Bridge Over Troubled Waters? Is that somewhere? We don't have that ready to go. Okay, I was going to just sort of use it as an example. But, I mean, you take something that is a well-known song like that, and the character that you inhabit for that is what then, Marilyn?
I don't know. I think it's when I sing a song like that, I'm drawing on my roots of having sung my entire childhood and young life in church and really having sung music close to that kind of thing, you know, Protestant hymns. Mm-hmm. I Come to the Garden Alone, and I even made a recording of hymns with Tennessee Ernie Ford many years ago, called Our Garden of Hymns, yeah. And I remember that when we first did started the recording session, it was actually kind of wonderful because we had just done a show on television, Ernie and I, and that's how we met, and Andy Griffith was on the show too, and it was Jim Nabors' show, who's a very dear friend of mine, and they all became great friends. But when we arrived at the parking lot in the morning at Capitol Records in L.A. to start recording, Andy Griffith was in the parking lot playing his trombone, I Come to the Garden Alone. But when Ernie and I first started rehearsing, he turned to his manager and he said, "She's been there." And I think you have to have been the place that you're going to with these songs, whether how you relate it to yourself or it's probably so convoluted.
I don't know. We're right back to where we began. You're grown-ups now.
You know, one of the
You're right. That's it.
One of the earliest memories I have is just a little girl. In the 30s, my father, this was before my sister was born, I suppose. They would bundle me up in the back seat of the car, and particularly in the summer months, and we'd drive to a nearby black church and park outside. The windows were all open, and listen to the music. So
wow.
I grew up with all of that wonderful gospel stuff, you know, and that has, I think, informed my singing in some ways.
At that time, would you not have been able to go inside the church, Barbara?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I might have been uncomfortable.
Tiny little girl, right.
Yeah, I was so little. I was really like 2 years old.
But you remember it still.
Absolutely, yeah.
1-800-423-8255. Let's see if we can get to Raleigh, North Carolina. Joel is with us now. Hi, Joel.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I have a question for both both your guests. With regards to the maturity of their voices, what do they attribute their voice maturity to? I, like them, grew up singing. I think my mother mentioned that I was humming and singing before I could actually talk. And
sounds
I found,
right.
And now that I've gotten a little bit older, I'm now in my 30s, I've actually listened to my voice mature over the years. I don't think of anything specific that I've done, but something has changed within my physiological makeup or what have you to make my voice a bit better. And what do you two attribute your voices changing and improving so well over the years to?
Well, I think you just get older. Part of it is a natural process.
Yeah, it's part a natural process and experience of singing. Plugging it in and singing all the time. That great experience that one has.
Learning how to deliver when you're supposed to deliver.
Right.
What you have to do
in
order to
do it. But you both teach, right?
Yes.
You're at Juilliard, Barbara, doing master classes there?
No.
Not doing that anymore?
I do them occasionally. I'm not really part of Juilliard. I come in as a guest teacher from time to time.
And Marilyn, what's the school where you're...
I'm permanently at the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara.
Chair of the voice department.
Yes, that's a summer school.
And what's the one point that you find you've got to get through to people that you're teaching now that they don't necessarily get from their other vocal coaches? What's the experience that you can give them now that you might not have been able to teach them 30, 40 years ago?
I certainly don't think I could have done it 30 or 40 years ago.
Oh, you couldn't have even done the teaching that you do?
I don't think so. I was too busy thinking about myself. But, of course, having done all that thinking about myself is the reason I'm able to teach.
Well, I think... I don't know what how early I might have done this. I don't know. But I don't teach technique. It doesn't interest me to teach technique. But what I would say the bottom line of what I try to do for people is to tell them that they are okay, that they're all right, that we are all always enough, that you're enough. You are always enough if you are able to get in touch with if you're able to really be present. So that's what I try to do, is give people the ability to be present and to not think, oh, I have to sing like this person or that person, or I have to behave in this way or that way, but to be present and to be alive for who they are that day, because our emotional temperature changes every day, and to not think, oh, I have to sing it like I did yesterday, but right this minute, how do I do it?
I think that's really great advice. The problem with what I teach is I would love to just teach expression and musicality and what you should do here. But I start to hear the students and I hear, whoops, there is a technical thing that's got to be fixed. So it's very hard sometimes to get by the technical because the technical demands of the operatic world are so much greater.
Let me see if I can squeak in one more call here. This is from Providence, Rhode Island, and it's Neil joining us. Hi, Neil.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling. These two women, you know their voices?
I do very well, actually. Marilyn, I've listened to you for actually just the past few years, and Barbara, I just came upon your Mostly Sondheim CD about last year, and I came out of the musical theater and jazz traditions, and I have just recently come upon opera, and I'm a tenor. I just started my first year in graduate study. I have a wonderful teacher, Patricia Craig.
Oh, I know Patricia. I know Pat Craig, absolutely.
Yeah, she's an absolutely wonderful teacher.
Yes, for
and
sure.
I just wanted to comment on how much I take to heart your comments about how you really must put yourself into the lyrics and how that will really help you concentrate and add that specificity to your performance, as opposed to just concentrating on singing and judging yourself on singing. You know, it's really about forgetting about singing. If you have the technique, it'll be there.
Thank you. Just said the operative words, though. If you have the technique. Because if you don't have the technique, then you're going to go get the cart before the horse.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
I hate to say that, but I say this to all my students. You get your technique together and everything will fall into place once you start thinking about words and you start thinking about your character and everything. Just got to have that solid foundation.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's got to be there.
And I just want to say thank you for your encouragement and for your voices and for everything that you've done for singing, especially young American opera singers. You know, I feel very hopeful into the world that I'm going into. And even though I know it's a long road, I'm only 22, And
that's okay. That's a good age. That's, you're doing fine. Good luck with everything.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in, Neil. You know, the one thing about the baseball analogy that doesn't work is that baseball pitchers always have relievers in the bullpen. You know, they can be halfway through a game
you're
and so someone's
right.
going to come in.
So right.
Yeah, that's true.
Or what are they called? Savers? I think we've had a few savers in opera when somebody's pooped out in the second act and somebody has to come in and finish the opera. They're called covers or understudies.
But it doesn't happen
in baseball, they're savers. Gee, the Red Sox couldn't be saved last night. I watched until the wee hours of the morning.
Shame on you. You have to perform
And I'm a Yankee fan.
I want to thank both of you for spending an hour here in the studio. Barbara
thank
Cook, it's
you.
Been great having you here. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much.
Marilyn Horne, a delight. Thank
it was
you
fun.
So much.
Thank you. You're terrific.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
The sun comes up. I think about you. The coffee cup. I think about you. I want you so. It's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends. I think about you. I talk to friends. I think about you. And do they know? It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon, doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor,